It strikes me as almost improbable that there would be anybody who might still not know who the next people are, who we're going to hear from about technical innovation in this next panel. We're going to hear from Bob Heiber. You can come up, Bob. Bob has been working in film sound preservation and restoration since 1990 when he joined Chase Audio. He is a member of AMIA, SEMTI, ARSC, and the Academy of Motion Picture and Arts and Sciences. He has served on three national panels for the Library of Congress and has spoken on film sound preservation, restoration, and remastering at conferences around the world. Prior to joining Chase, Bob was a studio manager at Warner Brothers and an award-winning 16mm filmmaker in Chicago. Peter Ollier began working in the field of audio preservation at Indiana University's Archives of Traditional Music, running the Audiovisual Lab. He has worked for the Library of Congress for the last 13 and a half years. His major contributions include converting the Library of Congress's magnetic tape preservation lab from an analog to a digital facility, the planning and designing of the audio preservation lab at the Packard campus, and as a partner with the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in the development of audio imaging technology known as IRENE. And speaking of IRENE, Carl Haber is a senior scientist at the physics division at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. His research specialty is the development of instrumentation for high energy particle physics. He has worked on experiments at Fermilab near Chicago and at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland. You hear the Higgs boson when he's not working with ARSC? Since 2003, he has collaborated with colleagues at Berkeley and at the Library of Congress on the development of optical methods to restore recorded sound non-invasively. This research has led to the creation of a number of general purpose tools for scanning and analyzing mechanical sound carriers. It has also been applied to the recovery of a variety of early historic sound recordings. These include items from the recordings from Alexander Graham Bell, the Volta Laboratory collection at the Smithsonian, Edison tinfoils, and the 1860 Leon Scott phonautograms. And if that's not enough, I had dinner with him last night. He also knows a fair amount about barbecue. Gentlemen.
Thank you, George, and good morning. If you guys want to take out your hymnals, turn to page 3. I'm going to just give a very brief, the Cliff Notes version of what is in the report for the section that I was privileged to work on, which was education, training, and research. And since it's a morning of shout-outs, I want to first thank all of the committee members who worked with me, who really educated me and brought a whole range of ideas and energy to this that really made this a very rewarding process, and I was very, very happy to be able to take part in it. So Aaron Biddle from the Ethnomusicology Department at UCLA, Ellen Cunningham Krupa from the Kilgarland Center at the University of Texas, Austin, Gary Marcianini from the Library of Information Sciences at UNC Chapel Hill, George Massenberg, who actually made time and made a few calls between mastering things and teaching up at McGill University, and Conrad Strauss at the School of Music at the Indiana University. So you can imagine the conversations that Conrad and Brenda had over the dinner table for a good year. We kidded about that. I'm going to read pretty much verbatim what the points were and then just very briefly summarize. So it's in the program, but here's what we came up with. The first was establish university-based degree programs in audio archiving and preservation. And to me, this was a very interesting discussion because I work in the commercial sector, and the university sector is, you know, the areas of higher learning actually have commercial purposes as well, which was something I was educated in. And we're going to have a whole separate module on education. We'll talk about that more. But we identified three areas where coursework should be developed: administration and management of archives and collections, physical conservation and reformatting of legacy audio recordings, and then management of digital audio assets and storage systems. And the takeaways were to consolidate this experience, encourage funding and support, and to help develop really the hands-on internships and practical experience that's so important for people to really understand how to work with these materials and the mediums. Obviously, coursework is good, but as we all know, the School of Hard Knocks is really a great teacher. Sometimes unforgiving, but still a great teacher. Next was to establish continuing education programs for practicing audio engineers, archivists, curators, and librarians. So as we gain greater understanding into all these different disciplines, you know, we need to make sure that everybody is aware of what we're learning about, so that people just sort of don't do it the way they've always done it, if there's actually becomes a better way to do it, or at least expose them to those opportunities. So we need to be able to be good communicators. The third was to create a collaborative online resource to collect, vet, and disseminate knowledge and best practices in the field of recorded sound preservation. Again, the idea of creating open access to the knowledge that we are all able to share. Not everybody can come to an ARSC conference or to the other different conferences. So we have to, again, make the information available. The area that I am personally most interested in, of course, is encouraging scientific and technical research, leading to the development of new technologies to recover, reformat, and preserve audio recording media. And that's kind of the big purpose of this module right now. The goal here was to develop, and this is important to me, efficient means for preservation of recorded media. And areas that need research initiatives are quantifying the life expectancy of our formats, identifying and creating an easy-to-use diagnostic tool so that people who aren't experts can quantify and be able to make a compelling argument for what's happening with their collections. Library of Congress has a good group that is doing some of this research, the Preservation Research and Testing Division. Develop chemical and physical analysis research, more science, to really understand what's going on other than the practical experiences that we face when we pull materials out of boxes. New technologies, which as I said is one of my favorites, develop methods to permit easy quantification of the performance of digitizing systems. That's one of George's favorites. And foster collaborative research methods both nationally and internationally. There's a lot of work being done around the world, and we need to make sure that we have access to that and that we collaborate with these people. It's very interesting when you do some research about how technologies developed, you know, back before really what we might say is the information age, there was so much parallel development going on in the United States and going on in Europe that people didn't know about, and they were all trying to get to the same goal line. So now, again, to be efficient and make the best use of our time, we need to collaborate with these people. We need to be working with them. And finally, one that really is probably maybe the get started point, and because time is of the essence, is to research, collect documents, and preserve information in legacy recording practices and technologies before it's too late. So we want to take people like Steve Simoleon here and put them in an ISO box and freeze them cryogenically so 100 years from now we can take them out and understand and we'll do things like that. But basically to create a national directory of obsolete equipment and obsolete audio engineers, to actually do interviews and do demonstrations, you know, like the how-to videos, so that when these guys aren't around to teach a younger generation, there will be learning resources. And to, this is a very good one, to create a digital repository of the manuals and schematics for all of the legacy equipment. So there would be a national place where people could come and say, so how did that thing work and what's the alignment procedure? And again, that's something that could get started tomorrow if we could get that to go. So that's basically what we came away with. It was a lot of hard work, but it was a lot of fun. And again, I thank the committee members that helped put this together. Thanks.
Given us some short talking points that I guess we're going to go through those. So I've been kind of asked to talk about what a manager would do if a approach with a collection that might or might not need some sort of new technological advance in order to deal with it. It also seems that it's very important to say that with any collection, if you're just waiting for some technology to come and magically solve any problem, nothing's going to happen unless you do basic preservation, triage, making sure you're in proper storage condition, making sure you have housing that's proper for your collection, and documentation. A lot of the collections that come to our project have come to us and have been noted as being important and valuable, and would not have just magically married up with our technology if it weren't known what the condition was, what is on these recordings and things like that. So without doing those basic things, you're kind of lost. So if you're just waiting for something to magically make everything easy, it's not going to happen that way. I thought I'd talk a little bit about why I was attracted to what Carl and Carl's colleagues came up with as an idea of how to deal with imaging sound recordings. When Carl actually did a pilot study imaging a disc, actually Goodnight Irene by the Weavers, and wrote up a report on that. And when reading it, it happened to come through to the Library of Congress at the time when we were actually wrestling with issues of high throughput, how to deal with massive amounts of materials that needed to be digitized for access and preservation. If the technology that Carl was presenting to us seemed to only be applicable to high throughput, I might have not pursued it as heavily. It's because it was clear to me when reading his report that it could deal with possibly high throughput issues, it could deal with fragile and degraded media, it could deal with media that we didn't really have any players to deal with. It even presented itself as possibly a measurement and analysis tool. And the fact that it had all these options made me think that a research project, which doesn't necessarily promise that there's going to be a usable device at the end, had a big chance, a much higher chance of succeeding than just a one-shot deal. And there was a lot of risk here. In fact, when we started this, the library kind of said, we don't develop technology. But it's clear that one thing that's changed over the years is that just buying off-the-shelf hardware doesn't always work. That rolling your own and figuring out how to leverage technology for your use is a possibility. And I think this one project shows that it is a possibility. It's not easy. It's not fast. It's not cheap, necessarily. But it's a possibility. And so in going into the project, I had enough knowledge to know that this seemed feasible. And so pursuing it seemed like a good risk. But if you're out there and you're thinking that you have either media that is problematic, and you just think that magically something's going to appear that will deal with that media, it's likely not going to. Carl, as George was saying, works in high energy physics and has a very serious job, discovering the birth of our universe and things like that. And we're kind of small potatoes and. So, but defining the problems that we have and presenting them to people who understand these technologies, can lead to solutions and or even just other areas of information or knowledge about what we're doing. And I think that in itself is really, really valuable. And so I think knowing a lot about your collections, being able to define your problems, being able to start to talk interdisciplinary conversations with different fields of people leads to good things. And so I'm definitely would encourage people to pursue ideas they have and relationships with other people in other fields, but to just think that it's going to kind of solve all your problems, that there's some magic bullet out there that applies to your particular situation is I think probably unwise. It takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of direction to solve those problems. And I think I'm going to pass to Carl now. And Carl's going to give you some questions.
Okay, thank you. So I guess the sort of question that George posed to us was, what has technology done and what hasn't it done? Is that a fair thing? So I mean, I come to you as sort of an outsider. I didn't come up in this community, and my background, as was said, is in physics research. But I tend to be interested in problems of measurement and instrumentation, and so it was sort of natural to look, when you heard about a problem that had a technical dimension to it, it was sort of natural to think, well, this is like an interesting problem. There's a universe of sound here to discover, so that was attractive. And I have to say, just to make a clause here, that I found that this community has been very hospitable and very welcoming to people coming from another technical field, in terms of, you know, saying, you know, go away, what do you know about our issues? It hasn't been like that at all. And so it's been a real pleasure to interact with the audio preservation archive community and have a home at the Library of Congress. So thank you very much. So obviously technology in many fields is a huge driver. It's almost like a locomotive that's just barreling down the tracks. So in physics research, in the life sciences, in semiconductor materials, I mean, you're constantly developing new technologies to enable measurements and understandings of things, and we're rewriting the rule book and the way we do things over and over again, and it's just a total engine. My impression is that in there is a field called preservation science, obviously, and works on all sorts of issues of inks and pigments and signals and sounds and all of that. Obviously, the research component is smaller than in these very historically technical fields. But I think there are impacts to be made by new methods and new technologies. But of course, you have to balance those with the tried and true methods that you've known how to do and have worked for you in many, many regards in the past. And so it's a big question to you. When do you take the technology route and take a risk or try to develop or invest some of your precious resources in a new direction? And when is that not a good thing to do? And so that has to be balanced kind of with careful thought by people who are thinking carefully about the needs of a field. In our case, I think Peter and people at the library, you know, kind of took that question and said, this is worth doing, okay? So we embarked some 10 years ago on this road. What have we done? I think we've explored a lot of different questions now in this particular region of optical methods for audio. We've explored a lot of different alternatives and tried various things. We have a set of tools now that continue to evolve, and we've used with some success in a variety of places. So, for example, the very historical sound recordings that are unique and special from the 19th century, we can hear most of them today. And I think to a large extent it came about through this research, I think, right? And I recall there was a piece, even I believe Tim Brooks was quoted in the New York Times a year or so ago, saying that there's been an outpouring of historical sound recordings recently through technical analysis. That's something that certainly very tangible thing that technology has done for the audio field. The bigger thing is kind of developing a tool set that can be used in a very robust and general way to look at large collections and really digitize research collections that people want. Scholars and people want to have access to. So I think technology has given us some ideas about what it takes to do that and what the quality and what the results of such a study of such studies would be, and it's given us an indication of what quality we could get and what would be a comparative result, but you know, of this kind of an approach versus another kind of approach. There hasn't been another sort of federal cylinder project yet where you really take a large collection of thousands of recordings and pass them through this. But I mean, we're getting to the point where one could, at least from a feasibility point of view, you could start to consider what it would take to do something like that. I think it's important to emphasize that what we've done with the Library of Congress and our other collaborators is a relatively small thing in terms of the number of people that's been involved and, you know, the investment that's been made, you know, relative to other big technology activities in society. I mean, this has been in very, very modest. It's been done, you know, basically in a government academic setting, not in a commercial setting. We've had armies of really bright students, you know, contributing their efforts to it. And so it's been a great educational activity for them, but we've gotten probably an 80% return on our time invested in educating these young people, but they've returned a lot of good tools to us. You can see, right, with a modest investment, you can judge for yourself where we've left you after sort of 10 years. So I think you can consider the, this has been a pilot project in, like, let's work with physicists or engineers outside audio and see as a collaborative thing, you know, what can we do? So we've done this pilot project, and I think, you know, it's sort of 10 years down the line, you can judge for yourself. Another thing I want to say is that you know, it feels to me like, in a sort of modest way, we developed a kind of a little sub-discipline, which is optical methods for recovering sound recordings. And there's, you know, a bunch of people in the world now working in this area. And, you know, we've even started to basically develop practices, best practices for how to do this. When we've sat with collections from the Library of Congress, from the Smithsonian, from the Phoebe Hearst Museum, from the Archive of Traditional Music, from Schenectady Museum, from the Edison National Historic Site, and, you know, we've gone through a whole bunch of different materials, and we have now experience and knowledge how to deal with these things. So there are, you can start to write down practices for this new discipline. I'll pretty much end in just a moment with my comments, but just the other thing which always have struck me about this moment as in the history of sound recording and the interplay between technology and other methods and so forth is, you know, how 25 years ago, you made the analog to digital transition. The number of people that kind of bridge that world are vanishingly small. The information about the legacy carriers and all of the, you know, we're just sort of at this magic moment where, which will never happen again in history, you know, where you remember what was done before, you're grappling with all these new issues. 50 years from now, 100 years from now, you know, the world will be totally a digital world. There'll be nobody around that remembers how this was done. So I feel like this is sort of the right moment to be doing this kind of research, because we're straddling those two worlds. And I always, that was something that impressed me when I thought about it. So
I was struck when I heard this story last night from Peter about how incredibly serendipitous it was that he came to meet Carl. That, you know, there was somebody in the lab who was playing around with this idea. Well, you know, maybe what happens if we point all of our measuring things instead of at semiconductor services and we look at, say, a disk? and somebody was just toying, pursuing an idea, and that report filtered through, and Peter just happened to see it and happens to have enough of a physics background to be able to read that report and say, you know, this might actually be something. So, you know, the whole serendipitousness of the way this came. But one of the things that I know has been talked about in the report and the studies is how audio preservationists should seek out other communities, you know, other disciplines to help solve our problems. You know, watching Bill Klinger work on the Cylinder Box project and taking his hard science background and knowing about things like, you know, 3D manufacturing, you know, 3D printing is actually feasible and it was applicable to this. So, I know Bob's done some R&D and brought products to market, and, you know, Peter's sort of done that now, right? We sort of have Irene and 90 DCCs bringing this product to market, and you work in this world and you've seen how looking at the problem of disc playback from a different perspective. I'd be interested to hear from each of you, what other disciplines might we approach to help solve these problems? And defining the problem as generically the obsolescence of the machines, what technologies might we apply to the conservation and reproduction of audio materials?
Clearly, in the work that we've done with the Library of Congress, it's been mechanical sound carriers, grooved materials, where the sound is essentially stored in the profile of a surface. When you go further out into the universe of carriers, obviously there's magnetic media and optical media and so forth. So now we're talking about other types of measurements that would have to be done. And then there's all the issues of degradation and physical evolution of materials. So it's chemists and it's material scientists and people who understand how to measure magnetic materials. Those are big communities of people that you know could contribute to what you do. Another thing, though, another thing is that this didn't really come up, but when we make a measurement, and this is going to be the case in the magnetic domain and so forth, we create a large amount of data. And that data has to be analyzed. And there's a lot of information in that data. It's not just the information of what the audio content is, but there's all sorts of information about the nature of the media, its degradation, what condition it's in. And that information can be analyzed and extracted in a variety of ways. So I think it's very important to work with people in the areas of signal processing, optical, image processing, optical analysis, statistics, big data, applied mathematics. I think that there's like a whole universe. I keep using the word universe. You got me going on this. There's whole worlds of insight that you can gain by milking this large amount of data that you're going to acquire when you start doing very detailed measurements. So I think there's a whole range of technical and scientific disciplines that if you could start to interact with them, bring something really to the needs of your field. And I remember there was this panel that we did that CLEAR organized as part of this process a couple years ago. And I remember Betsy Cohen invited a professor of statistics from UCLA to come and talk to the committee. I think the statisticians and the people who think about big data have really something to offer looking into these data sets and extracting information from them.
I mean, I think it depends on, George's question was focusing on basically playback machines. I think those fall into a couple of categories. I mean, if you're talking about the obsolescence and the slowly going away playback machines that are available, you know, if you're trying to deal with media that's in playable shape and isn't degrading terribly, the machines that have been developed over many, many, many years. I mean, if you talk about what Studer or Scully or any of the major manufacturers of tape decks have done, you know, the idea that you can suddenly re-engineer that in some new way, you know, very quickly and replace it, I think is unlikely. I mean, many, many, many years and lots of money was poured into refining those devices. One thing that I think people expect though out of technology is something that's, say, non-contact. That's obviously not a traditional tape machine. And if you're talking about a whole new technology for that reason, that's a different kind of ball of wax. So you'd have to evaluate what the options are for the particular kind of media you're dealing with and what the technologies available are and how to, Carl was talking earlier about scaling those to the problem. So those kind of things come up. So.
Really, what the plan speaks to, though, and it's something that really needs to happen, is to develop really, you know, technology incubation and to bring together the collection of these scientists and be able to present to them what our problems are and then let them tell us, because certainly, you know, I'm not a scientist per se, you know, where do the solutions lie and how viable will they be? And if we give them our wish list of what we want to get done, we need to see this happen. And the plan speaks to creating this kind of national effort to make it happen. So really, again, that's a really good first step kind of project. It doesn't take a lot to convene a group, find out who are the experts in a whole number of fields, and can you come someplace nice? Hawaii comes to mind, actually, as a spot. And sit down and have, you know, just literally a bull session, and you come with your wish list. Here are all my problems, bringing examples of what these are. But it's not just the problematic elements that we have to deal with. It's the quantity of elements that we have to deal with. And I hate to sound like a broken record, particularly in this conference, but the reality is we have more than 100 years of recorded media, and we don't have 100 years to recover it now, okay? That's a simple fact. And we don't have 100 years worth of engineering expertise to recover it in traditional methods. So we have to look for alternative, efficient methods based on the kinds of material it is and what the carrier is to be able to recover it if we want to recover it. And that's another discussion as to whether or not what should or shouldn't be saved. But the reality is that we just don't have the time. And so I think, as Carl points out, this is a kind of a pinnacle point to begin this discussion and get it started, because as we know, technology, you just don't pull it out of a box. It just doesn't happen overnight. It's a difficult process. It takes a lot of money. It takes funding. So we have to find all of those things. But the first thing is to find out, where do these technologies lie? What disciplines can bring their talents to it? Who's interested in working on it? And then moving forward, you know, from next steps. It always starts with small steps. You can't just jump, oh, I need a magic machine that will do this. I'd like to have, you know, a dishwasher for audio tapes. I could just drop them all into the machine, press the button, and they've all been digitized. That would be a great, great process. That's not going to happen. I use a miracle cleaner, so it works out very good. So the plan speaks to this. So really, you know, we could look to our executive director here in the audience and say, so, you know, when do we move forward to our next steps, Pat?
When Congress said. So we have about maybe 10 minutes, depending on how long-winded Sam's going to be in his presentation. I want to open the floor up to a little bit of brainstorming. And to ask or to invite some contributions to Bob's wish list. And we'll play a little bit of Stump the Chump up here with our panel. And try to be fairly specific. And we'll see if we can take, say, we'd like to have a solution for sticky shed syndrome. And we know there are different approaches to this. And, you know, Eric Breitling was showing us how infrared spectrometry and a little statistical analysis was leading to some direction on that. And then we also have food dehydrators as the different options. And so, you know, we want to try to see if we can find some more of these hard science solutions, like what the lab at the library is doing. So, who wants to put something on the wish list of a problem in audio reproduction and preservation that might be opened up to other disciplines?
I'm sorry, George. This is a more of a comment directed at what was said, and then we can get the ideas. But this is Josh from University of Illinois, and I want to confirm essentially what Carl and the others have said about reaching out outside of the direct discipline. Literally within the past couple of weeks at University of Illinois, we've decided, at least in the past couple of years there, in my time there, there has been this insular thinking that, you know, the guys on the north side of campus, the huge engineering schools, those are the ones that, you know, they're all about new technology. They don't have any, they'll never, wouldn't have any interest in messing around with this old stuff and blah, 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 blah. But we're finding that to be far from the case, and just to confirm that it makes sense to reach out to these guys. And if we reach out with a couple problems, we're finding guys in electrical engineering, guys in physics, guys in material sciences that are interested in this stuff and see it as, you know, very cool stuff to be involved in. So just want to kind of second what was said up at the panel, that it does make sense and there is interest out there. And these guys, a lot of those guys on that side really like to solve problems. And if you bring them a crazy complicated problem, they might dive in. So that's it.
I think that's absolutely correct. But at the same time, we don't want to keep reinventing the wheel. And I think one of our problems, I'm Jenny Doctor, I'm from the Belfer Audio Archive, and the Belfer, you know, in the 1990s, was working on the whole idea of laser optical, using two lasers to read grooves on cylinders. And then the project didn't continue to be funded, and so I think it's fallen by the wayside, although the electrical engineers who were working on it are still interested in trying to pursue it. But the point is, at this point, would what they're doing just be, in a way, not needed because of the work that you have been doing? Isn't it better to try and make the work that you're doing really available to those of us who are dealing with highly degrading media? I was delighted to hear somebody just mentioned Irene is going to be available to us to use. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit. Because, I mean, we have some materials this week that we've been dealing with that are truly falling apart. And I would love to have somebody read the grooves now while we still can. We don't have another 10 years for some of the materials that we're working on. We really need to start getting it read and safeguarded now. So I'm just wondering, it's great to reach out to people, but how can we actually get to some of the amazing science that has already started working on these? How can some of us in archives start making use of that now?
Okay, so I thought the question was more like, what would be a new problem to work on rather than don't reinvent the wheel, which is fine. But just to address your specific question, there are optical scanning systems at Berkeley, at the Library of Congress. There are a couple of them. And there's a project underway to establish optical scanning capabilities at the Northeast Document Conservation Center, which is in Massachusetts. And it's an organization that does, you may be familiar with them, that does paper and book and other and imaging, but so this will be a capability that will be established there also. So in principle, you know, it'd be exactly for an institution like yours that has a academic collection and wants to have it preserved. Presumably, to, you know, within the limitations of the technology, whatever they may be relative to your collection, there could be restoration, preservation, whatever seem, you know, is the appropriate word for what you want to do. So the hope is to make this available as sort of a service. So that would be a tangible answer to your question. You know, it's happening now. It's sort of this over the course of the next year. It's actually stuff is, you know, things are being drawn. The money's there. Yeah, that's the way to put it. Yeah, the money's there. Yeah. Okay. You really should talk to any DCC.
Here's my little question, if I may.
I think your microphone's not on.
Oh.
So that's a technology issue.
Is it? Okay.
All right, now I'm here. Here's my simple problem it's a quickie for me, but it's complicated for other people, perhaps. There is two Edwin Booth made recordings of Shakespeare in 1890. One of those has been available on the vinyl and 78s and in the LPs of vinyl, and it's moved on to the age of the World Web and Google, and anybody can hear that one recording of Edwin Booth. But there's a second brown wax cylinder that was so problematic that it has never been duplicated. Here's my question. Is there any way that we can use some other system to get the sound on that second Edwin Booth cylinder? And then what steps do I take to do this if it's available?
Okay, so the, excuse me. For something very specific, it's a one problematic historic cylinder or three or four, some small number of things. You know, typically over the past 5 or 6 years, problems like that have come up a number of times. And I mean, we have the bandwidth to handle a project like that. I mean, we could work out some arrangement because it's such a special item, and we stand to actually learn something technically useful that can benefit the whole, you know, our whole knowledge base by looking at something very problematic, very old. So I would imagine that if it's just one cylinder, if it could be brought to, I don't want to speak for the Library of Congress, but if it could be brought to Berkeley or maybe to the library, I mean, we could scan this cylinder. Such things have happened. I mean, 2 years ago, from the Bishop Museum, they came with this one cylinder that purportedly contained the voice of the last king of Hawaii. I mean, so projects like that, the Edison tinfoil, these things can be done.
Do you know why the cylinder is problematic? Is it broken? Is it the grooves degraded? Do you know?
Personally, I know nothing about this. I've only heard about it, that it's unusable.
Okay.
But
I can tell you that, unfortunately, the cylinder from Hawaii, there was nothing that we could hear on that cylinder. But that's typically not the case.
But I think
unfortunately, we're out of time, and we need to leave some time for Sam. If having hopefully stoked some thoughts here, I would encourage you, I'm going to volunteer the co-chairs of the ARS Technical Committee to be the recipients of ideas for this wish list that Bob mentioned of technical problems that we might solve. And maybe even on the ARSC list, there could be some discussion about which disciplines we might reach out to, from big data to high energy part.
Yeah, and I would be happy to respond to any question, you know, through email or phone or whatever that follows up from this point.
Let's thank our panel.